السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله وكفى وسلام على عباده الذين اصطفى وعلى آله وصحبه ومن تبعهم بإحسان إلى يوم الجزاء وبعد. Welcome everyone to our weekly online حلقة on the essentials of Hanafi fiqh. The essentials, not only on Hanafi fiqh, but on creed and law. We had finished a couple of weeks ago the sort of main areas of creed. We began last week, I think session number six, I think it was. We began looking at the types of ahkam shar'iyya, the types of legal rulings, the rulings that are deduced from the sacred law by the jurists of Islam, and why it is important to know the hukum shar'i. Because when it comes to acts, human acts, we are not allowed to make up a ruling using our mind to judge whether something is allowed to do or not allowed to do, whether something is obligatory to do or not. We have to follow the text in these matters. And the text refers to the Kitab and the Sunnah and anything indicated by these two. The other thing, the reason why it's important is because before we do any act, we must know the ruling before we do the act. So if we don't know the ruling before an act, we are not allowed to do the act. We are not allowed to do the act. And so we have to know the hukum shar'i before we embark on doing an act. And so it becomes imperative that for our daily acts, we know what the rulings of Allah and His Messenger are, which means that we have to know what fiqh is, what the body of rulings related to these everyday actions that we do. So we also looked at the meaning of fiqh and usul al-fiqh. So fiqh is to know the knowledge of the rulings related to human actions. And usul al-fiqh are the principles that a mujtahid, someone who's qualified, who has legal expertise, to go to the Kitab and the Sunnah directly and understand the ruling. So usul are principles, qawa'id, by which a mujtahid, someone qualified, to go to the Kitab and Sunnah directly, the principles used by a mujtahid to extract the hukum shar'i, the ruling of Allah Azza wa Jalla and His Messenger on a particular act. This ijtihad also becomes part of the body of legal rulings of a scholar, so the fiqh of that scholar. A lot of the legal rulings are not deduced, i.e. they're not things that a mujtahid had to derive because the rulings are clear cut. So fiqh isn't just doesn't include the ijtihad, the effort of a jurist or mujtahid derived from the Kitab and Sunnah, but the fiqh also includes rulings that are very clear cut in the religion when it comes to matters of law. Okay. So once we know what these rulings are, then what we are going to see is that we're going to come across matters related to purity and prayer that carry these different types of rulings. So some are going to be fard, some are going to be wajib, some are going to be sunnah, mu'akkada, emphasized sunnah, some are going to be non-emphasized sunnah. So fard is an obligatory act, a wajib is a necessary act, and things like that. Um, So this is why we had to know these categories. So we're going to begin today the chapter on purification, Tahara. And we're going to do ghusl today. And then next week we will begin Salah. That will probably take us up, in all likelihood, up to Ramadan. And we may even finish the book before Ramadan. It may not be likely, but this is the plan, bi-idhnillahi ta'ala. And then maybe to break for Ramadan, inshallah. Okay, so the author of the essentials, absolute essentials, mentioned Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. And may we benefit from the author's book. Allah Azza wa Jal says, Allah Most High says, and if you are unclean, purify yourselves. And then Allah loves those who purify themselves. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, purification is half of iman. Purification is half of iman. Imam Ghazali, Allah have mercy on him, explained that this purification relates to the purification of the outward and the purification of the inward. So Imam Ghazali explained that this purification relates to the purification of the outward, which is a condition for the validity of our outward acts, and to the purification of the inward, which is a condition for the soundness of our hearts and souls. So when we look at purification, there is the bodily purification, of course. And this is what tahara sort of means legally. It refers from one's body, one's garments, and one's place of worship, place of prayer. Tahara also means, purification also means removal of one's state of ritual impurity, yeah? Ritual impurity. There are things that you might actually be physically clean, but that doesn't mean you are prepared to do a ritual act, an act of ibadah. There may be that there are things that you may have to do that the Sharia requires us in order for us to be pure, to undertake some act. So tahara could be the physical removal of any filth or cleaning one's outward body or place or clothes. And it can also refer to ritual impurity, impurity that is related to worship. But when Imam Al-Ghazali is talking about the purification of the outward, which is our limbs, yes, there are acts that we have to do to make sure our hands and feet and face and whatever other body parts are required to be clean must be clean. But there is also a tazkiyah, a kind of purification of the inward. And that is actions that are not visible by anyone else except for the person to whom the action belongs. So things like intention, niyyah, one's sincerity, one's ikhlas, things like that. These are qualitative things that are related to a person, but no one can see them. People can see the effects of them, that's true, but I can't see your intention. I may be able to see the results of your intention from the acts that you do based on your intention, but I can't see your intention. I don't know, you wouldn't know, and I wouldn't know the quality of your sincerity. Wouldn't know the qualities of your sincerity, of your intention. Now, the Sharia has come to give ways to measure whether our inward states are good or not, or whether they're developing or not. The Sharia has given ways or checkpoints or sort of rubrics by which to see whether our inward quality of worship and engagement with acts of worship are good or not. So the Sharia has come and brought that. Otherwise, we would never know how to improve these things. And these are, you'll find these in the books of works that are to do with augmenting the nafs, the works on purification, on tazkiyah, on tasfiyah. Of course, you find them in the books of tasawwuf, on Sufism. But in all honesty, you don't need to find these only in the books specifically written by the people of Tasawwuf. You can find these in general works written for how to improve one's quality of worship. So the author begins with a ritual bath, the ghusl. Interestingly, he begins with ghusl. And in a purification, washing the body to ritually purify it can be done with water that is from a natural source, like rain, springs, rivers, you know, the sea, lakes, even water from, like, you know, melted snow and hail. Yeah. As long as natural water retains its quality as water, nothing is mixed with it that destroys its natural qualities of being a water, then it can be used to purify any place of worship, any garment, it can remove any filth from one's body, one's clothes, wherever one is. Yeah. So this is like unconditional purified water. So there's nothing that can make it not be water unless something changed its nature. And water that is this natural water from rain, you know, wells, rivers, lakes, whatever it might be, if such water is stored, again, this is still water that's purifying. Water that's pure, sorry, and purifying. This is water that can be used for any act of purification. And so long as nothing has destroyed its characteristics or its nature, it can be used to purify. It can be used to purify or be used for acts of ritual impurity. Okay, so the author mentions the ritual bath. I'm going to read it until the end. And then we'll go through it step by step. Okay, the ritual bath, the ghusl. The ritual bath, the ghusl, consists of three obligatory actions: rinsing the mouth, rinsing the nose, washing the entire body. One must wash everything that is possible to wash without genuine hardship, such as eyebrows, ears, the belly button, the moustache, inside of the beard, and all one's hair. Women should move their earrings so that water reaches the pierced area. It is not necessary for a woman to undo her braids or ensure that water reaches all of her braided hair as long as it reaches the roots of her hair on her head. However, it is necessary for a man to undo his braids even when the water reaches the roots of his hair. And so, so that ends that part of that section of the ritual bath. Then the author continues. The ritual bath, a detailed description from beginning to end. Before performing the ritual bath itself, it is an emphasized sunnah mu'akkada, to number one, begin in the name of Allah and make the intention while washing your hands up to the wrists. Number two, remove filth, if any, from your body. Number three, wash the private parts, even if free from filth. Number four, perform a complete ritual ablution, wudu. Then begin your ritual bath. Number one, wash your entire body three times, starting each time from the head, followed by the right side of the body, and then the left side of the body. until the till the toes. Number two, it is an emphasized sunnah to rub one's body the first time. There is no harm in using soap and the like during the ritual bath. One should avoid the following. One should avoid the following because they are disliked. Because they are makruh. Facing the direction of prayer, so or supplicating during the ritual bath. Wasting water. Excessive waste of water is sinful, while waste is generally blameworthy. So that's the reading of the section. So let's get back to the beginning section. So the ritual bath, the sort of furud al-ghusl, the obligatory actions of the bath are the following. So we have to rinse the mouth entirely once, entire internal of the mouth. So we've got to rinse the nose up until the soft bone here once. And then washing the entire body. And then the clarification is given there where it's got to be without difficulty. It's got to be without difficulty. So when we say a mouthful, usually the mouthful in the books of fiqh, just take it up so you can see it. So rinsing the mouth. When you rinse the mouth, you don't need to have a mouthful. So it doesn't need to be like mouthful is usually defined as, you know, your mouth can't hold something anymore and it starts to burst out. Your mouth starts to strain to hold the contents. We're not talking about that. It's just rinsing, ensuring that there's sufficient water to rinse it. So when it says wash the entire body, the clarification there is given in the paragraph. So it's got to include eyebrows, ears, belly button, moustache, inside of the beard, all one's hair. Of course, including the roots, whether that's the skin underneath the beard or wherever it is, the skin, the water has to reach the skin. So anyone's body shape or size, where there may be folds in the skin or areas where water may not reach just when water touches the body from outside, whether from a shower hose or whether from someone pouring it, wherever it is, however the water is falling on the body in whatever way, we have to make sure that every part of the body is wet. It's and the water has reached it such that water flows off the body. Yeah. Water must flow off the body. So there must be sufficient water to allow water drops to run across the surface of the body. So the inside of the navel, I hear this putting the belly button, inner parts of the ears. Yeah. And so really any part where water may escape, we must ensure that water reaches there to fulfill the obligatory requirement of water washing the entire body. And then there's always mention the water is not necessary for women to undo her braids will ensure that water reaches all of her braided hair as long as it reaches the roots of her hair on her head. But men have to unbraid their hair if their hair is braided or tied or for whatever reason. The hair is bunched up. Men must untangle them, unbraid them. Okay, so let's go then on to the ritual bath. From beginning to end, a detailed description. Now, for amongst the emphasized sunnah, the sunnah mu'akkada, remember that category we did last week, the emphasized sunnah, the sunnah that our Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam hardly ever abandoned, and that there is a sanction for intentionally abandoning the act of sunnah mu'akkada unless there is an absolute valid reason not to do it. So the Prophet did, the sunnah is in the following order. So you make your intention before you disrobe, i.e. before one, embarks on washing the entire body, before they disrobe, it is sunnah to make the niyyah. And that is mentioning Allah's name, the basmala. And so once that is done, one then wash the hands up until the wrists. Then one removes. Well, you got two things here. After you washed your hands up until the wrists, you have to now either wash your private parts, the front of the private part and rear, sufficient is fine. There's no reason to be excessive in doing that, the front and the back. So you wash the private parts, the front and the rear. Then you wash off or remove any filth from your body, even if there's no filth, actually, because it's a sunnah to do it, yeah, to wash the private parts, even if there's no filth on it. But if there is any filth on the body, you must remove it. So you wash your private parts, you remove the filth from the body. You perform a complete wudu. And now we haven't gone through the acts of wudu yet. Normally would go through wudu and then ghusl, but the author has put ghusl forward first. So we'll come to wudu next week. So once we have performed ablution or wudu, a full wudu, we then begin the acts of ghusl. We begin the acts of the ritual purificatory bath. And that involves the following. So washing the entire body three times. And now if... if someone... is in, let's say, a lake, like what happens in many South Asian countries, and they're in there for a sufficient amount of time, which, you know, the body can be, the time that it takes to wash the body three times, all of the entire body three times, if someone is submerged in like a lake or river or a small pond, for that duration of time, then the person would have fulfilled the sunnah of washing the body three times separately. They would have fulfilled that sunnah. But if they're not in a pond or a lake or a river, if they're not in a naturally enclosed quantity of water and they're submerged in it, and they wash their body, you know, and they're not submerged in it, but they're washing their body three times. They're not submerged in it, then they need to wash their body three times, yeah. Starting from the head. It's got to be from head to toe, but it's got to be starting from the right-hand side and then the left-hand side of the body all the way to the toe. So it's from the head down by the right-hand side all the way to the toe, the left, and then going down all the way to the toe. That's got to be done 3 times if someone is not in a pond or river, submerged in a pond or river or a lake or a sea or the ocean or whatever it might be. It is, again, a sunnah mu'akkadah to rub one's body the first time. And whatever one uses to rub the body, and that could be a cloth, that could be using whatever, shower gels, soaps, these are entirely permissible. Yes, it is disliked to face the Qibla when one's doing one ghusl, especially when one disrobes, because then one is facing the Qibla in a state of nakedness. And wasting water, excessive water, is sinful, while waste is generally blameworthy. Now, so there is some discussion amongst ulama whether pouring a bathtub full of water is considered to be wasteful. And so, you know, and whether having a bathtub is even some people say that if a drop of impurity from the body falls in a bathtub, because the bathtub is not large, the quantity of water is not large enough, that entire bathtub will become impure and can't be used. The water cannot be used to then purify the body. So, you know, you'll have a bathtub full of impure water that cannot be used for purification purposes. So, it is religiously economical, shall we say, and more in line with the sunnah to sort of use the shower or to fill one's jug with sufficient amount of water to fulfill the obligatory aspects of the ghusl. No one's saying it's unlawful. So, you know, no one's saying you can't sit in the water by running a bathtub and sitting in the water. Like, no one's saying, for example, you can't add like bath soaps or bath fizzes, or I don't know what people use these days. You know, decorate your bath with candles and things like that. I'm not saying these things are in and of themselves impermissible. These are permissible things. But it's superior, it's better to pour water over oneself, whether under a shower, which takes the ruling of running water, or using a pitcher or a jug, whatever it might be. Because again, that uses less water, which our Nabi alayhi salatu wasalam commended. And of course, it's more effective in cleaning, because sitting in a bathtub, again, like I said, if an impurity falls in the bathtub, all that water cannot be used for ritually purifying ourselves. Now, there are some adab, the Hanafis do say, when it comes to the bath, that, you know, the Hanafis do consider covering one's nakedness, awra, i.e. from the navels to the knees, ideally, like with like a loose wrap or a garment or something like a towel or whatever it might be, a cloth, and sitting down on some kind of stool to shower. These are not sunnah mu'akkada, but they are something that's at least performed once. And so are a means of reward. And it is an expression of modesty as well, haya, before Allah Azza wa Jal and before the angels. And so it is better, because haya is so recommended, and one ought to be scrupulous about one's modesty, one's haya. What was the other thing I wanted to say? So it's not impermissible to run a bath But we want to be, we want to try and emulate the Sunnah as much as possible. Now, regarding the mouth as well, what about if bits of food or you know, sort of food bits remain in the mouth? Does that have to be flossed out before we do ghusl? Because it says here, washing the mouth, rinsing the mouth, right? So food between the teeth or stuck between the teeth, things like that. Now, if the food piece isn't to such a large extent that it prevents the water from reaching the mouth, the entire mouth, then one's ghusl is not affected. Yeah. There is no expectation that I know, Allahu A'lam, there's no expectation for a person to floss before they go into the bath. You know, give your teeth a sort of a complete sort of clean before you go into the bath. But it is emphasized sunnah to use the miswak, of course, in the wudu, as we'll look at, as we'll see soon when we do it next week, inshallah. What else on this issue? Let's see. Okay. So let's go on to just a few more rulings related to the ghusl not mentioned here. When is ghusl obligatory? And some of this we'll touch on, of course, further down, but I'll mention it now. It's fard, it's obligatory, meaning if one doesn't do it, one is sinful. So it's obligatory when one of the following three things happen. One, if there is an emission of sexual fluid from the male private part, many, the sexual fluid is emitted, so that thick white fluid that exits in spurts after an orgasm or a kind of lustful discharge, that obligates ghusl, it becomes fard. And this could be, if this emission happens because of whatever reason, a wet dream, or, you know, for some other reason, some lustful reason, or some sort of pleasurable reason, then ghusl becomes fard, obligatory. The second cause for doing a ghusl is if the top part, the head of the penis, enters into or disappears into the female private part, the vagina, or in the rear orifice, in the anus, which is haram, of course, but if it does happen, and it happens out of passion or desire, then ghusl is obligatory. Even if there's no emission of semen, even if there's no emission that occurs, nevertheless, the mere penetration, the tip, the act of penetration necessitates ghusl. The other obligatory time for ghusl is when a woman ends her menstruation, or when she ends her postnatal bleeding, i.e. the bleeding that comes after or remains for a time after a baby is delivered. So these are the three times when ghusl becomes fard. One must do ghusl in these instances. Ghusl becomes wajib, necessary, for the following reasons. Some say it's wajib for when a person becomes Muslim, for someone who reverts to Islam, then ghusl is wajib. But the other opinion is, and Allah knows best, probably this is the stronger opinion, is that actually it is fun. So we would add that to the first three. Anyway, so those are the rulings related to obligatory reasons for obligating ghusl and the reason for necessitating ghusl. One's fard, one's wajib. Now, what are the recommended sort of nafal or mandub recommended times to do the ghusl? It's recommended to do the ghusl. If you don't do it, you're not going to be sinful, but it's good to do it because it's recommended. Is the on the Friday before the Jumu'ah prayer. The same, so same will be for before the Salat al-Eidain, the two Eid prayer, Eid al-Fitr and the Eid al-Adha. When one enters into the state of Ihram during Hajj, if you're a pilgrim, the day of Arafah, so those on the Hajj, so after the midday, the Zawal, that time, the midday time, after that midday passes, the Zawal passes, it's good to do the ghusl. The cases that I mentioned are also considered to be emphasized sunnah. So sunnah mu'akkada to do it for Jumu'ah, Salatul Eid, state of Ihram as well. These can be categorized as sunnah mu'akkada. You find that in the books of fiqh as well. Entering Mecca al-Mukarramah, when you enter Mecca to do the ghusl. When you're entering Medina al-Munawwara, when you're entering the blessed city of our Nabi alayhi salatu wasalam, and when we're doing ziyarat rawdat al-Nabi alayhi afdalu salat wa atamu taslim, or when doing the ziyarat of the qabr rasulillah. So when we're visiting, making our visitation to the best of creation, we should do the ghusl. It's emphasized to do, it's good, recommended to do the ghusl. Now, ghusl, those are sort of the sunnah acts of ghusl. Now, ghusl is not necessary if pre-sexual fluid is emitted. So that pre-sexual fluid is the madhi, which is a sort of a thin fluid that emits when one is aroused, but there's no sperm that's emitted. There's no mani. The same will be for when any murky sexual fluid is emitted, and that's known as wadi. So this does not necessitate ghusl. So any cloudy liquid, the wadi that emits out of the private part, that cloudy whitish sort of liquid, there's no need to perform the ghusl if that comes out. Either one of these are emitted. So madhi or wadi, the thin liquid before what they call arousal fluid from when someone is aroused, that doesn't necessitate a ghusl. And post-emission of semen, so any fluid that comes out after semen has been emitted, the cloudy, white, cloudy, sort of murky fluid, that doesn't necessitate a ghusl either. Ghusl is not necessitated if someone wakes up from a wet dream, but yet there is no wetness. There's no evidence that there was any wetness. So there's no need to do ghusl then. That includes the same for a woman. Doesn't matter for a man or a woman. The insertion of a finger into the female private part, that doesn't necessitate a ghusl. And there are other rulings as well, which we may not have, we don't have to mention, but they don't necessitate ghusl. So that's in a basic way, the sort of core rulings, absolute core rulings related to the ghusl. I'll stop it there. I'll end it there. And then if there's any questions or comments anyone want to ask, they can. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Just stop sharing that. I'll let people just reflect on it. If there's no questions, of course, we can hold the questions off until we go through maybe, you know, further on into the Tahara section, because we will be covering wudu next week. Bi-ithnillahi ta'ala. Okay. What we will do then, we will allow people to think about any questions they might have. And then we can, if there's any written questions that come in, we can take it for next week. Otherwise, we will pick it up bi-ithnillahi ta'ala next week when we do wudu, which will be slightly longer. I think it's about 4 or 5 pages. And then we will go on to the Salah. We'll be covering the Salah, which is longer. I will try and cover that in, I'll try and cover that in up to before Ramadan. I may not be able to. I'll see, depending on how much I have to cover. I will try and do it before Ramadan. If not, we will pick it up either through Ramadan or after Ramadan, if we do break for it. Okay, so next week, inshallah, we'll begin wudu. We should finish wudu in the lesson, and then we'll begin salah. And that may take a couple of lessons. And then, bi-idhnillahi ta'ala, we would have wrapped up the integrals of rituals, of belief and rituals. And I will then see if I want to cover other parts of the book, like the appendix and things like that. I'll let you know. And inshallah, you know, if it's beneficial, we can cover it. Inshallah. In that case, I will leave it for this session and I will see you all in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.